We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
To the tables down at Maurice, to the place where Louis dwells, to the dear old temple bar we love so well.
Good morning and welcome to Focus on WILL AM. I'm Jim Meadows filling in for David Inge. And the Whiff and Poof song, sung there by the Yale Whiff and Poofs, is probably not the most popular college drinking song these days, but it is a college drinking song, a proof that college students have been drinking, often to excess, for a long time. They're certainly doing it these days, and why they do it is the subject of a study and a new book by Thomas Vandervin called Getting Wasted, Why College Students Drink Too Much and Party So Hard. It's published by New York University Press. And good morning, Thomas Vandervin.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
And just to let folks know, you're a professor out at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, where I assume college students do their share of drinking.
That's right. They do. There's plenty of drinking here, as there is throughout our nation's campuses. But, you know, just like any other university, there's some heavy drinking here, but there's also some people who don't drink at all and some minor to moderate drinkers. And we have a lot of other great things going on here at Ohio University, some strong academic programs, and we're real proud of what we do here with our students.
Well, what questions came to mind that you wanted to study, since it's such a widespread phenomenon that people either take part in or wonder at or worry about? What questions did you want to answer in doing your study of the subject?
Okay, well, here's the fundamental question. Past researchers who've studied college drinking have mostly surveyed individual respondents and asked them how much they drink and among other things, what are the consequences of that heavy drinking. And we've learned a lot about the distribution of heavy drinking among college students and some of the bad things that happen to them. So my fundamental question was, since we know that so much can and does go wrong in the drinking scene in terms of violence, sexual victimization, students not doing as well in school as they would otherwise, sickness, arrests, and all that, why do they continue? So I designed my study to try to understand the social process of college drinking and how they work together to decide when to drink and how they work together to deal with these negative consequences that I mentioned.
And, you know, I guess that brings up the sort of social divide you'll see in any college town, which is, you know, a lot of people, the townies, really looking down on the college students who often when they see them, they're most likely to see them when they're out drinking. And the students themselves taking part in that drinking who just have a whole different feeling about that same experience.
Yeah, that's true. That's pretty typical for their that kind of tension between a community, university community, and the students who are there. Sometimes students forget that they live in a larger community. They don't see past the campus. They don't see the effects of some of their partying on the rest of the community. And so that tension is there. Students don't, you know, they're well aware of the risks and the dangers and the negative consequences of heavy drinking, but they feel that it's such a part of college culture, and they really are getting a lot out of it. There are many different kinds of emotional payoffs and benefits that they see in the drinking scene.
I was struck by a phrase I came across early in your book, and that was collective drunkenness. You hear about stereotypes of people drinking alone. Drinking is not something that most college students do alone when they do it, it sounds like.
That's right. You know, I collected 469 drinking stories where I asked students, they were open-ended qualitative surveys, I asked them to describe for me the last time they drank to intoxication. And the reason I asked about the last time is because I didn't want them to tell me about the funniest time or the most exciting or, you know, whatever, the most consequential time they drank. I was trying to standardize the responses. So I asked them about that last drinking episode and who they drank with and how much they drank and what happened. Very few. I can't say how many, but I'd say in single digits of my 469 stories were people drinking alone. I mean, they're drinking together. It is a collective activity, and drinking is a process that is managed collectively from the moment they decide to start drinking until and through the next morning when they're managing hangovers together.
You write in the book that you interviewed students at three different types of colleges, a small liberal arts college, a public university that's sort of a commuter school, and a public university, a big public university in the Midwest, which for all we know could have been the University of Illinois at Urbana, from which I'm speaking now, which certainly has its own drinking problems and drinking traditions. I don't know if it has a similar counterpart at Ohio, but there will be a big drinking event coming up in March or so. That's here called Unofficial St. Patrick's Day.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to believe here that that we invented it, although I've certainly seen the name in other places.
Right.
And I understand the history here in Champaign-Urbana is that a group of bars started it as a promotion because the actual St. Patrick's Day back then happened during spring break. They couldn't promote that, so they made up a St. Patrick's Day.
Interesting.
But it's grown beyond the bar promotion, and I would say the bar is no longer promoted because of all the pressure they're under from city officials. Someone, however, manages to decide when unofficial St. Patrick's Day occurs, and it's a weekend. It brings in a lot of people from out of town. There's a large amount of drinking. City officials and the police departments here are usually very stressed and vigilant during that time, and an awful lot of the drinking is not done at bars. It's done in private parties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, most big universities have an equivalent weekend or week. Here at Ohio University, we have a major Halloween block party, and the way you described that, unofficial St. Patrick's Day, I think some people in Athens here think they invented Halloween, but we are known for that major event. Yeah, these are events that are associated with heavy drinking. When students come to a university that has that kind of event, they're forecasting heavy drinking. They know that that's going to take place, and it's almost like, you know, there's sort of a cultural mandate to get involved in that and to get heavily intoxicated. And those are events where a lot of times some real catastrophic consequences take place. The collective intoxication can get out of hand. There's violence. There's people drinking dangerous amounts. And those are the kind of events where universities should think seriously about developing bystander intervention programs so that students are out there looking out for each other and feel responsible and confident to respond to dangerous situations in the drinking scene.
I want to get back to that bystander intervention program concept in a minute. First of all, I just want to reintroduce my guest. He's Thomas Vanderven at Ohio University, and he is the author of Getting Wasted, Why College Students Drink Too Much and Party So Hard, published by New York University Press. And over what course of years did you interview the students for your study?
The first drinking stories were collected around 2003, and I collected data through 2009. Most of my data, over 60% of my data, were collected at that large Midwestern State University that you mentioned. So I collected these drinking stories, 400-plus. I did 25 intensive interviews, and I also did a lot of field work so that I observed the drinking scene in bars, at street festivals, and at house parties. I observed drinking games. I saw a lot of this stuff up close. It's another thing that sets my book and my research apart from past research is that I actually observed this stuff, play out in real time.
Well, I want to mention that we welcome calls and comments from our listeners. You can call us here at Focus at 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-9455. A little further out, you can call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455, and you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. One thing I wanted to get back with is, you know, first of all, this is not just, you know, drinks before dinner. We're talking about college students who are essentially drinking to get drunk.
Yeah. Again, when I ask students about their last drinking episode, one of the things I ask them is, why did you decide to drink on this particular occasion? And that, some of them found that to be an unusual question, and acted like nobody had ever asked them before. And some of them said, well, it's college, of course I'm going to drink. Or a typical answer was, I drank because it was Thursday, and we always drink on Thursday. But I also got varying answers about how intoxicated they intended to be. So while some of them said, you know, I was ready to get wasted. I had a stressful week, so I was planning to get very intoxicated. Or my friends from out of town were visiting me, and we really planned to get drunk. Or it was my friend's 21st birthday, and we really wanted to get him or her hammered. So in some cases, they talked about this intent to get heavily intoxicated. Others said, I was just looking for a nice buzz. I don't ever want to get really drunk because I don't want to get sick, and I don't like to feel out of control. So there's a belief that college students are all, you know, out of control in the drinking scene and really trying to get drunk. But it really varies. We also need to know there are plenty of college students who don't drink, or who drink in moderate ways. So sometimes the intent is to get really intoxicated, but not always.
And that raises the question, and maybe some of the previous studies that you mentioned get into this, is to what percentage of college students are doing the heavy duty problem drinking?
Okay, since 1993, the College Alcohol Study started in the early 90s, and Henry Wexler and his associates at the Harvard School of Public Health have done this nationally representative survey on college students. And so we know since the 1990s that about 44% of college students nationwide are involved in binge drinking. And that number has not changed much since the early 90s, which is interesting since efforts to prevent and reduce heavy, high-risk drinking on our college campuses, different kinds of prevention programs and education programs, have really increased dramatically, but that number has not changed from 44% over those years. The other trends are we've seen in the last 10 years or so more abstainers on campus, so an increase in the number of people who don't drink at all, and an increase in frequent binge drinkers. So think about it as an increase at both ends, more abstainers and more heavy drinkers.
It's the moderate drinkers, which sound like they're on the decrease then.
Yeah, you know, and some of this you have to look within certain populations. You know, we've seen some increasing binge drinking among women off campus housing. You know, it's usually associated with, you know, there's all kinds of myths and stereotypes around this. There's a lot of attention given to Greek houses and its fraternities and sororities, and certainly people involved in Greek houses have a higher probability of being involved in heavy drinking, but it's taking place in the dorms, it's taking place off campus and off campus housing, and it's pretty pervasive.
Have there been any shifts over the years of this study of either who's drinking? I think you mentioned more binge drinking among women, but where drinking is being done, difference in the sort of social occasions?
Well, I can't really answer that. I think I'm not sure about that. I think, you know, it's remained fairly stable as far as where it's happening. I mean, if you look, there definitely varies. I mean, there are some students, there are some universities that their binge drinking rates are, you know, in the 70% area, and some where they're very, very low. There are so-called dry campuses where there's not a lot of heavy drinking going on. But the major trends are the ones I've mentioned.
And besides men and women, were there any other demographic divisions besides on who was drinking and who maybe not so much?
Well, we know that college athletes have a higher probability of being involved in risky drinking. If you're talking about race and ethnicity, African-American college students are less likely to be involved in binge drinking, which is interesting. We don't have a lot of data on that. That would make for good future research to try to understand some of these racial differences. The other things we don't know. You know, a caller on another show suggested that academic major and social class and some of those things might matter, and those are really topics for future research.
You discuss as part of the whole social process about how students work together, both some of the social processes, everything from drinking games and just various planning for occasions to drinking to figuring out how they're going to manage the level of their consumption. And I was just struck by how involved it's gotten.
Right. The important point here is that, again, the stereotype, the image of the college drinkers is out of control, sort of haphazard, inviting chaos. But college drinkers, at least some of them, are systematic about what they do. So that I had a respondent, she was talking about how she and her roommates had a house meeting. And they said, okay, so when are our classes this week? And they all figured out that they didn't have an early class on Wednesday, so that they were going to do their heavy drinking on Tuesday nights. So they see that as responsible drinking. It's not that they're not going to get heavily intoxicated. They are, but they're going to do it in a way so it's least disruptive of their academics. There's something that students do, and this is something that I encourage, and that is a buzz check. And a buzz check is anyone does this when they're drinking. It is a reflective moment when the drinker says to him or herself, "How drunk am I, and do I need more, and should I continue?" And it's an important moment. If people do this buzz check and are careful about it, then they kind of know their limits and don't take themselves to dangerous levels. Some students do the buzz check and say, "Hey, I'm not drunk enough." Or they decide as a group, you know what, we better hit this a little bit harder because we're not drunk enough. So I heard students talk about it in that way.
And that also brings up the question is how good are the students' judgment when they're trying to, evaluate their own levels here? You give some examples which seem to suggest that it can vary.
Yeah, it does. And that's a great point. How good are they? And the more they drink, sort of, their inhibitions are lowered, and maybe their judgment gets more and more blurred as they drink. Some of my respondents talk about drinking as a learning process, so that you can learn how to be a good drunk or learn how to be a good drinker, and that maybe early on in their college career they got very intoxicated and sick and passed out and got into trouble, and there's a socialization process where maybe their co-drinkers will tell them, you really need to eat before you drink or eat while you're drinking, or you should mix in some water. Some part of the culture is your co-drinkers will say, drink one glass of water for every alcoholic drink you have. There's different kinds of folk methods to avoid sickness or dangerous intoxication. So I think there's a learning process about how to do it in a less dangerous, less harmful fashion. There are tutorials taking place in the drinking scene.
But it is folk wisdom, I take it. It's not like you can go down to the campus medical clinic and ask for advice on how to manage your binge drinking on Friday night.
No, but you know what? I mean, it has really become managing your blood alcohol concentration has become part of campus programming. So something that a lot of universities use, and I suspect that University of Illinois uses alcohol EDU. I'm not sure about this, but I'd be surprised if they weren't using alcohol EDU, which is an online instructional program for first-year students. And we have it here at Ohio University, and students have to take alcohol EDU online their freshman year. And what it does, it actually gives some advice about how to manage your blood alcohol concentration. And it tells you things like eating before you drink, eating while you drink, knowing the alcohol content in your drink. So if somebody at a party hands you, you know, one of these red or blue plastic cups with an alcohol drink in it, know what's in that. Have a sense of, you know, how much alcohol people are giving you. And so these are programs that are saying, look, we know there's going to be some drinking. They're not going to preach abstinence. They're going to say drinking is going to take place. But do the things that you can do to reduce the amount of alcohol that you consume. Try to pace it and try to be reasonable about this so you don't find yourself in a dangerous situation.
It's interesting. I just went online to find a six-year-old article from Alcoholism and Drug Abuse Weekly citing a University of Illinois professor, a researcher, I believe, Andrew Wall, who has concluded that students who completed alcohol EDU reported 50% fewer health, social, and academic consequences from drinking. That's one of the studies mentioned in the article.
Excellent. I mean, I'm not, you know, look, my daughter is a freshman at Ohio University where I am, so I'm a sociologist, but I'm also a parent. And she took alcohol EDU, and it was, you know, the first time I'd actually talked to a student who'd taken it. And they actually are, you know, some students I'm sure take it and go, this is, you know, forget about it. They're just preaching, and there's just another thing to ignore. But you can learn something from that program about managing intoxication.
That must be a unique situation. This is something that you've been studying as a social phenomenon, but now your own child is entering that community, or potentially entering it by being a college student.
It is interesting. And when I, you know, this was a long-term study. When I finished the book and as I was writing the acknowledgments and the preface, she had just graduating from high school and about to enter college. And so as I was writing that and thinking about this, you know, took on, you know, more of a personal weight or, you know, a level of importance for me. And, you know, I'm seeing from her and hearing from her some of the things that go on in the dorms in terms of people who don't drink trying to fit in. I think we need more research on non-drinkers and how they manage the social scene in college. Are they stigmatized? Are there other kinds of opportunities for them to socialize and that sort of thing? So, yeah, as a parent, yeah, I'm seeing it up close from a different angle, definitely.
I'm thinking back to something you said earlier, and that's really the assumption, at least among the drinking college students, that this is something that college students do. It's just part and parcel of the college experience. I suspect it goes back centuries, but. But how did that happen?
Well, how did it happen? I would say that, I've said this recently, that college is in some ways sort of it creates a constellation of variables that create the perfect storm for the drinking scene. First of all, you've got many young people converging on the campus at the same time who are for the first time away from parental surveillance, so sort of off the leash for the first time. That age group, that 18 to 22-year-old age group, you've also got a lot of young people who are searching for identity. It's an important time for identity exploration. So you've got the lack of supervision. You've got people trying to find themselves and find each other. So you have people new who are new to campus and trying to meet new people and trying to develop friendships and romantic relationships, and they believe that alcohol lowers their inhibitions in ways that allow them to approach people that they're interested in, to allow them to, in the terms of my respondents, let the real me out. And So you've got all those factors, and then you have all these young people who don't have strong bonds to social institutions like family and work. So most of them have, you know, they have families of origin, but they haven't started their own families yet, and they don't have jobs or careers. They don't have these social institutional obstacles that keep them from drinking. So you could drink four nights a week in college because you don't have all these other obligations. Once you get out in the real world, so to speak, with a family and a job and all that, it's harder to maintain that heavy drinking. So I think all of those factors have existed for a long, long time in college, and I think they persist today.
We're going to take a quick break. This is a Focus on WILL AM 580. I'm talking with Thomas Vandervin of Ohio University and the author of Getting Wasted, Why College Students Drink Too Much and Party So Hard.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
And want to remind listeners that in the second hour of Focus this morning, Rick Atterbury will be filling in for David Inge, and the subject will be disaster planning, and specifically local disaster planning. Be talking with John Dwyer of the Champaign County Emergency Management Agency and Todd Short with the U of I Police Department and their Office of Campus Emergency Planning. That's in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus. Right now we're talking with Thomas Vandervin about getting wasted and why college students do it, and the experience they're looking for, which I take it is an experience, even when we're talking about the very heavy drinkers, that they like if they do it more than once.
Well, again, yeah, they like it. And again, in my research, one of the things that I asked them that I don't think had been asked of them before is, did you have fun? And if so, why? And they acted, a lot of them, like I was crazy. Of course it was fun. But, well, why? What did you get out of it? What did you enjoy about it? And a lot of it had to do with lowering of inhibitions, being allowed to do and say things they wouldn't normally do. But operating in a world where, and again, this is collective intoxication, operating in a world where almost everybody is behaving in that way, in that unbridled sort of carefree way, and it creates some interesting behaviors and interactions. There's a story in my book about some college students who go into Taco Bell, and there's an abandoned chair there on rollers there that's sort of broken at Taco Bell, and they take it, and then somebody gets some duct tape, and they tape this chair up, and they roll it down the middle of Main Street, pushing one of their friends at about 2 in the morning, screaming and laughing all the way. It's an example of the kinds of things that people do in the drinking. You will not see that during, you know, rush hour, during a weekday in the light of day. That sort of adventure and that sort of behavior is very typical of the kind of stuff that happens in the drinking scene. Those things create war stories, it bonds them together, creates this world of adventure that becomes part of a personal narrative for their friendship.
I want to take a phone call right now from a listener in Urbana on line one. Welcome to Focus. You're on the air.
Thanks. I'm wondering whether one strategy a student might use is to have alternatives for the money that the alcohol costs. For instance, I lend to on Kiva.org. It's a microfinance bankers to the poor organization. And it occurs to me that one thing to do with the money one would spend on alcohol would be to create a pool for oneself to lend on Kiva and form groups that lend on Kiva. And use their alcohol money for that. There might be other fundraising one could do, but it occurs to me that turns not drinking into a positive group activity.
Well, I guess if you're talking about the non-drinking student population, you're talking about a group that's probably, for the most part, they're more serious students. They are involved in other kinds of organizations and activities that bring them together, for example, students that would be on average more religious are more likely to be the non-drinkers, and they are those who are more involved in charitable stuff and social activism and all that. So if you're talking about non-drinkers using their time in more positive ways, my guess is that's probably already happening, and your suggestion is a good one.
No, I'm suggesting that it be all suggested as an alternative for people who would like to not be part of the drinking scene but are. And it's interesting because on Kiva.org, guess what the highest loaning group is?
The highest loaning group?
Yes.
I don't know.
It's the atheists, agnostics, skeptics, freethinkers, secular humanists, and the non-religious.
Interesting.
One team. And they're on path to loan $6 million.
That's
they're already above $5 million and have the most team members around the world.
Well, it's an interesting idea, and I hope there's some college students out there listening and thinking of this as an alternative. My guess is that most people involved in the drinking scene, if they don't want to be involved in the drinking scene, then they won't be. Most people who are committed to the drinking scene are because they're getting something out of it. They feel that they're benefiting from it one way or another. I think it would be difficult to discourage somebody fully invested in the drinking scene or to divert their attention to something else. Say, don't drink anymore. Here's this other alternative. They really feel like they're getting something out of it.
Just an idea for the person who is not fully committed to the drinking scene.
Yeah. No, it's a good idea, I think.
Thanks.
Thank you, caller. And that brings up the question to me for people who are fully invested in the drinking scene and going to college. Are you being able to tell from your research how much what else is going on in their lives? Are they being able to, first of all, juggle the drinking and their education, but any other hobbies or sidelights while they're on campus?
Well, if I can speak outside of my data, talking about the college alcohol study and some of the national representative data, we know that heavy drinkers are less likely to do well in school. So your question about being able to juggle their academic obligations and heavy drinking, some of them are not successful at that. Some people are real heavy drinkers and do well in college. So they do other things? Sure. Remember that I said that one of the highest drinking group is college athletes. So you've got collegiate athletes who are heavily involved in the drinking scene and are able to somehow keep up with school and sports in some cases. So yeah, I think they do other things, but I also think that for many college students, the major social context for meeting people and for blowing off steam and spending their social time together is indeed the drinking scene.
And that also maybe raises the question that the caller brought up, is that this costs money.
Yeah.
How much money does it cost to drink on a regular basis on campus?
I would love to give you an answer. I wish I had one in front of me. You know, I teach a seminar here, a senior-level seminar for our sociology majors on college drinking, and I have them do their own research. And one group did that. They surveyed students and asked them what they typically spent on alcohol during a week, and I can't remember what it was, but it was a lot. And males typically spent more than females in that tiny sample. And this is exploratory research, but one of the things my students were arguing was that males are going to spend more because they're more likely to be buying drinks for females. So they're spending a lot. How are they doing it? One of the ways in which they do it is jacking up their credit card debt, which is, to me, a terrible idea. College students, you know, coming out of college with this large credit card debt, and some of it, anyway, is some of that debt is due to heavy drinking.
You get to in the book, you know, starting just with some of the social conventions of the drinking scene on college, but you also and the positive reasons why students engage in it. But you also get into the negative things and the times when essentially you get into what you call a drinking crisis.
Right.
How often is that going to happen for college kids?
People who are heavily involved in the drinking scene, they will all, my guess would be, they would all at one point or another experience a drinking crisis. A drinking crisis varies. It could be getting sick, which is pretty common in the drinking scene. Interestingly, getting sick in college drinking culture is a very different kind of sickness. In everyday life as adults, when we are nauseated, we prefer to be alone. Where you're in the bathroom in agony, and if you're vomiting or whatever, you don't need a bunch of people in there helping you. In the college drinking scene, it's much more of a collective activity. So people help each other through sickness, and young women talk about holding each other's hair when they're getting sick. There's this sort of nurturing between college students that sort of appears like a parent-child relationship. When a child is sick, a parent takes care of him or her, and that's really what sickness looks like more in the drinking scene. So those things happen. There's a lot of hurt feelings in the drinking scene, and I think it's because people say things that they wouldn't normally say when their inhibitions are down. So hurtful things, there's a lot of relational problems, and then when there's a relational problem, you have co-drinkers or friends or roommates consoling each other, nurturing each other, giving support. So these bad things, like getting sick and getting upset, are redefined and reframed as positive things because people are helping each other, nurturing each other, supporting each other in ways that bring them closer together. So when I said, why do they continue to do these things when so much does go wrong? Part of it is because these negative things that happen create opportunities for them to care for each other and to sort of demonstrate adult competence. So even the bad things have a positive function, I think.
So these opportunities really for bonding experiences is something which will carry on in students' experiences and memories even after they're off from college and hopefully not drinking so much.
That's right. They serve as anybody who's gone to college and has been, even marginally involved in the drinking scene will have these kinds of memories and war stories with people they went to school with. I mean, just, think about it. Just, you find yourself in a group of people who went to school together, and a lot of times the context for their stories, not always, but many times the context for their war stories have to do with the drinking scene and the crazy, funny, or upsetting things that happen and how they work together to get through these things. Now, I don't mean to, act as if it's all positive and this all has a function. We need to recognize some horrible things happen in the drinking scene. People die. People are sexually victimized. These things happen. If we can encourage and facilitate students to look out for each other in more systematic ways, we can reduce those kinds of consequences.
You do talk about people you interviewed who talk about those instances of fights, of sexual assault, and of course, just the harm of drinking way too much. Despite efforts to manage it on the part of the students, it does seem to go on to a certain degree all the time.
Yes. Yes, these negative things do happen. We don't want to, understate that by, I don't want to just talk about all the fun and, bonding. Some bad things happen. But I think, for example, what they're already doing in some cases is looking out for their friends and their co-drinkers in situations that have the potential for sexual victimization. So let's say I'm out drinking with my friends and one of my female friends is really intoxicated and she's talking to some guy I don't know and she doesn't know and they start to leave the bar or the party. It's probably a good idea for me to say, wait a second, that's not a good idea, where are you going, intervene to show this unknown male that she's got people looking out for her. To escort your friends home is a good idea. Don't let your friend, intoxicated or not, walk home for a bar party late at night. Look out for each other. Take care of each other. They're already doing it, but universities can be more systematic about training their students to be good, effective bystanders. There are programs already out there in place, and we need more of them.
And these are programs which are essentially trying to control the damage as compared to programs which are trying to get people not to drink in the first place?
Well, we already have programs trying to get people not to drink too much in the first place. We have these like Alcohol EDU, and we have some of these different programs that are about prevention and education. So I'm saying let's keep doing those, but in addition to those things, there should be this kind of bystander training. But bystanders shouldn't necessarily be limited to just damage control after somebody's gotten dangerously intoxicated. They could be trained to intervene when their friends are taking their drinking beyond a reasonable level. So I would like to see training where through which students say, look, that's enough. There's not enough of that going on right now, where students are stepping in and trying to keep their friends drinking at manageable levels.
We have another caller waiting on line 4, a caller from Eureka. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Very interesting, I think, a constructive discussion. One hears in news reports, whether radio or TV or newspapers, of binge drinking going up drastically in many college campuses. Could you respond? Could you comment on that, please?
Well, I think every university, when you talk about dangerous levels of drinking and the drinking culture and what should be done, every university needs to do an analysis of their own campus and their own town and their own culture there and decide what are the reasons for the heavy drinking here. Is it the heavy alumni presence on weekends? Is it that the college, the sports teams, there's so much support and so much celebration around that, the tailgating and all that? Is it that there's easy access in our town for students, underage students, to get drinking? Are these cheap drink specials, these happy hours that promote heavy drinking in your town? So whatever the drinking culture is, or the social structure in every different college campus, they need to examine that and say, what is going on in our campus that's creating this? So there's not a silver bullet. There's not one program or set of programs that's going to fix this problem everywhere. The programs should be unique to fit each campus.
Okay, and I was wondering about that. You mentioned happy hours, and I realize here in Illinois, I believe happy hours are actually illegal. I think you can have a happy day, but you can't really fit special prices to a particular time of day. I think partially because of concerns about that sort of excess drinking.
Uh-huh.
You talked about before. Other groups who are not drinking on campus, about the abstainers, who could be everything from religious groups to reformed alcoholics, members of the straight edge movement, and I was wondering how big a factor are they on campuses now?
Well, as far as the group, well, I would say that groups that define themselves as by their non-drinking, I'd say there's not a real large presence. Straight edge exists and it's still popular in some places, but I would say that they don't have a real strong voice on most campuses, although people involved in straight edge are usually very committed and very disciplined about what they do. Most large campuses have religious communities and religious student groups that are very supportive of their members and those people who don't drink. So another thing is there is substance-free housing on campus. And people say, well, what do you mean substance-free housing? Shouldn't all housing be substance-free because they're underage, right? These are dorms. Well, substance-free housing is going to attract students who want to be non-drinkers and want to live sober, clean lifestyle. So I think substance-free housing is a good idea in terms of non-drinkers finding each other.
We have another caller waiting on line 1, a caller from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes. I was a binge drinker and I did it in Western Illinois University in the 70s. What we saw back then, I work in campus. I work with a student group on campus. I don't see today the wildness that we had. First of all, we had kegs in the dorms. The dorms were wide open. It was like a festival.
I believe the drinking age in Illinois was 19 at that time.
Well, but yes, it was. But it really didn't matter because our dorm was supposed to be limited from those things. But all the rules that are out there will be broken. The fact is that there was just a wildness, even in the frats, that, and I've been here 25 years working with college students. I'm a campus pastor. I just don't see the craziness in the streets that we saw at Southern, even here. I came here in the 70s to a football game, and it was a madhouse in the frats here because that's what I visited. I think we have a problem, no doubt, but I think it's better than it used to be, believe it or not.
Well, that's interesting. I think probably there are some places, again, it varies by campus. I went to college in the 80s. I went to Indiana University in Bloomington, and I saw some heavy drinking there, certainly. It's an empirical question that you raise. Is it really crazy or more out of control, more extreme today than it was, say, when you went to college or when I went to college? We don't know the answer to that. Because the best data on college drinking is produced by the college alcohol study that started in the early 90s. So we don't have data that compares your experience to the experience today. We do know that there's some heavy drinking occurring now and some really negative consequences. But I think, you know, you raise an interesting point because the question is it really that much worse than it used to be?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're right. I didn't think of that about the drinking age, but you don't have anything going on college campuses today like Make Me Smile event at Western where 3,000 people consumed hundreds of kegs out on the campus. You know, I don't have empirical data, but I think all of us adults at Western would laugh and say, you don't need empirical data to see what it was like. I know you're coming from a scholarly perspective, but
well, you may not need empirical data, but you're talking about a wide scale, out in the open, 3,000 people, whatever. The drinking may be that heavy still, but it's not in mass like that. So there may be 3,000 people getting seriously hammered, but spread across house parties, fraternity parties, street festivals.
Yeah.
So the level of drinking could be just as heavy. It's not this public display that you're talking about, maybe.
Have you done this? Have you gone out and walked dorm hallways on a Friday and Saturday night here at the U of I?
Well, I've never been.
Okay.
I've never done it to U of I, but I collected data on campuses where I did walk through street festivals and bars and house parties and through the dorms. So
okay.
I did that kind of work, but not at U of I.
All right. Well, I can't argue with statistics, but I don't want people to be too freaked out about the way it is today. I think we need to continue to work. But I think that this is actually a nicer generation of students in many ways than we were. And I'm not saying they're not pouring booze down their throats.
Right.
But
no,
all right, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, caller. And that raises, well, a couple of questions to me. First of all, the impact of community toleration, if the larger community looks perhaps at student drinking differently now in a college town than they did in the 1970s, and what impact, you know, whether does it just drive the same amount of drinking underground or does it at least curb some of the excesses of harmful public behavior?
Yeah, I think you're right. I like, you know, if we turn what you just said into a hypothesis, are communities, surrounding communities, less tolerant of student behavior and student drinking? My guess is that that's true. that there's more anxiety, more public anxiety about drinking than there used to be. I would say that that's true, and more community sort of frustration and irritation with it. And they work together to create noise violation policy and stricter policing of underage drinking. And does that really reduce the heavy drinking, or, as you said, does it drive it underground? That's my guess, that it probably drives it underground and causes students to be more creative and innovative about the way they avoid the agents of social control.
We're almost out of time here on Focus. I have one more quick question, and that was just noting that some of the recommendations that you come up with, you're pretty much stating that student drinking is not going to go away, but perhaps it can be less harmful to all involved.
I would say that. I can say confidently that it's not going away. For all the reasons that I suggested before about all the factors that contribute to it and make it an attractive enterprise for them. But again, I think we need to continue our educational and prevention efforts to try to encourage and convince students not to get dangerously intoxicated. But when they do, to be effective bystanders. We have like the Green Team at Dartmouth College, where they hire students to be present at parties and street festivals. They hire them to look for dangerous situations and to provide support for students who may have ingested dangerous amounts. We have the Red Watch Band group at SUNY Stony Brook that trains students to recognize dangerous intoxication, to know to administer CPR, to feel confident, responsible, to call 911, these kinds of things. So there are these programs out there that are addressing the dangerous situations.
Well, that's certainly something to keep in mind in any college campus where there's a lot of drinking going on. And I want to thank you, Thomas Vanderven, for being on the program this morning. Thomas Vanderven of Ohio University is the author of Getting Wasted, Why College Students Drink Too Much and Party So Hard, published by New York University Press. And Dr. Vanderven, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. Control.
We're almost out of time here on Focus. I have one more quick question, and that was just noting that some of the recommendations that you come up with, you're pretty much stating that student drinking is not going to go away, but perhaps it can be less harmful to all involved.
I would say that. I can say confidently that it's not going away. For all the reasons that I suggested before about all the factors that contribute to it and make it an attractive enterprise for them. But again, I think we need to continue our educational and prevention efforts to try to encourage and convince students not to get dangerously intoxicated. But when they do, to be effective bystanders. We have like the Green Team at Dartmouth College, where they hire students to be present at parties and street festivals. They hire them to look for dangerous situations and to provide support for students who may have ingested dangerous amounts. We have the Red Watch Band group at SUNY Stony Brook that trains students to recognize dangerous intoxication, to know to administer CPR, to feel confident, responsible, to call 911, these kinds of things. So there are these programs out there that are addressing the dangerous situations.
Well, that's certainly something to keep in mind in any college campus where there's a lot of drinking going on. And I want to thank you, Thomas Vanderven, for being on the program this morning. Thomas Vanderven of Ohio University is the author of Getting Wasted, Why College Students Drink Too Much and Party So Hard, published by New York University Press. And Dr. Vanderven, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
WILL programs are made possible with support from Art Mart in Lincoln Square, Urbana. Art Mart's deli, grocery, and bakery feature premium foods and ingredients for cooking and entertaining, including Newhouse chocolates from Belgium. Art Mart is pleased to support public radio.
The topic will be emergency planning in the next hour of Focus. Right now, let's look at the markets with Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Jim, and good morning, everyone. At mid-session today, futures are down sharply at the Chicago Board of Trade and in Kansas City, tumbling essentially, if you look at all the charts, about 2% on a broad commodity sell-off after the Federal Reserve warned of significant risks to the U.S. economy after its monthly federal meeting yesterday. Soybean futures are down at a six-month low, and corn and wheat are at six-week lows on a day when the stock market is also down hard, tumbling about 3%, and oil has been as low as 5% lower today. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. We'll begin in Kansas City, where December wheat is now trading at 744 and three quarters, down 15 and three quarters. May at 767 and a quarter, down 15 and a quarter. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 648 and three quarters, down 18. March 682 and a quarter, down 19 and a half. And May at 701 and a half, down 20.